Hello, friends, and welcome to the Caroline Gleick Show. Caroline here, I'm your host. On this podcast, we're going to be exploring a variety of topics, from adventure and activism, climate change messaging, mountaineering, skiing, relationships, and how we can use sport to change the world. I'm excited to have Rob Lee as my next guest. In 2019, he completed his ultimate world triathlon, where he climbed Mount Everest, swam the English Channel, and rode his bike across America, all in 6 months. He did it as a try for equality, to talk about men's role in advocating for gender equality. He was the 2012 world champion half Ironman in his age group, and he's climbed some of the highest mountains in the world. When he's not adventuring, he makes his living selling residential real estate in Park City, Utah, with his dad, Jim. Rob did one other very notable thing in 2019, and that was he got married. Welcome to the show, Rob. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on. Nice to finally catch up with you.
You married a pretty incredible woman. Tell me a little bit more about your wife.
Yeah, she's definitely one of a kind, and I am honored to be sitting right across from her right now.
So, in case you didn't know, Rob's also my husband. So, Rob, let's talk about your 2019. How did you even come up with this crazy idea to climb Everest, swim the English Channel, and ride your bike across America?
Yeah, so I think it was in 2016. I was having some ankle issues. I've kind of dealt with ankle issues most of my life. And I went in to see the doctor, and they confirmed that I did, in fact, need ankle surgery. But he also said that, medically speaking, I shouldn't really be running. And this was kind of a huge blow to me. You know, it doesn't mean I can't run at all, but I wasn't able to train the way that I would want to if I wanted to be basically a pro triathlete, which had been my focus for a long time. So right there sitting on the doctor's table, I decided I needed a new goal, something to like look forward to, and I came up with the English Channel. I'd been a swimmer my whole life, and I thought, okay, this is going to be my new thing, but I knew literally nothing about it other than it was this kind of iconic swim. So I ended up starting to research it, and I found out that they call it the Everest of swimming, and there's a lot of debate online of which one of these is harder. And so I decided, I wonder if anybody's ever done both to truly compare. It turned out that there were a number of people. I think at the time, I think it was 8 or 9 people had done it, but never in the same year. Usually it was spread out by years. So I thought, okay, that could be my goal. I'm going to try to do both of these, since Everest was also something I had considered doing. So that was kind of the goal. And then I realized, well, I'm kind of a triathlete, and if the climb is going to take the place of the run, and I've got the swim, then I need a bike. And so I came up with riding my bike across the country. I've always wanted to do that, and I thought, well, let's try to do that all in one calendar year.
That's insane.
Yeah, so then I started planning it, and just the way the timing worked out, all three events ended up happening within a 6 month period.
It was a pretty crazy 6 months.
It was pretty wild 6 months for sure.
What were some of the greatest challenges of completing your ultimate world triathlon?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest one, all three of these kind of events were sort of in my wheelhouse of things that I might be able to accomplish. And so, of course, there's a million things that could happen, whether it's weather, my own body or mind, that it's just not the right day or whatnot. But the real challenge was putting them into this short period of time, so that whenever I got to each event, when I started the swim, I felt like I was not really in top swim shape. And when I started the bike, I was in horrible bike shape. And that was what made it just that much more hard.
What was it like for your body? Like, talk to me about, I mean, I know obviously very intimately that some of the roller coaster, the experiences, the emotions. Talk to me about body size, body image, and specifically the transition from Everest to the English Channel.
Yeah, so going into Everest, I knew I was going to lose quite a bit of weight on Everest. And so generally, it's not the worst idea to have maybe a few extra pounds on you. When you're on the mountain for 40 days or longer, you're going to lose weight. You have less of an appetite. You're just not snacking or eating the same way you would at home. So I knew that going into it, but I also knew the biggest challenge of the English Channel swim is that you can't wear a wetsuit, and the water is quite chilly. It's about 60, 61, maybe 62 62 degrees in some spots. And so just kind of these old school rules, you can't wear a wetsuit. I knew I needed to put on some extra weight to do that. So I did a lot of cold water training. But the other thing I did going into Everest was I put on an extra about 20 pounds going into Everest. And then I lost 20 pounds on Everest. So when I got home, I had about a month and a half between the two events. And I literally just, instead of training, I just put on as much weight as possible. So I put on 30 pounds in 30 days, just in an effort to keep my body warm enough. Cause I knew as good of a swimmer as I could be, that didn't matter if you get hypothermia and they have to pull you from the water. So that was my main focus, was putting on weight. And then of course I finished the English Channel swim, and I had another big event coming up, our wedding, and I didn't really want to be, in all honesty, like I've never really worried too much about my weight, just because I've always been in athletics, and in all honesty, you can look at it like I'm a guy, so maybe I don't look, maybe guys don't worry about their weight as much, but going into my wedding, being literally as big as I've ever been, if I can say the fattest I've ever been, it wasn't really ideal. In my mind, it wasn't really where I wanted to be. And it gave me a new appreciation for kind of body image and that kind of thing. So I went into the wedding, the biggest I've ever been, over 200 pounds. And then the same thing with the bike, is I went in a lot larger than I would normally be going into an event like that.
How much did you weigh when I met you? I think we met in 2013, or was it, I think 2014, right around then.
I believe I weighed about 170, maybe 175 pounds at that time.
Yeah, you were pretty slim.
My triathlon weight when I was in the thick of things was just over 160. Literally, like my weight that I fluctuated around was 161.5.
That's crazy. And so when we got married, you were 205. So
I was probably, when we got married, I was probably just about 200, or just over. When I did the swim, I was 205 pounds. So yeah, definitely quite a bit heavier.
I mean, being your partner through this, I just thought it was really interesting, and I really appreciated that you were really open to talking about body image, because for me, like, I don't really hear a lot of men talking about body image, and I really loved and celebrated your body for what it could do for you. And so, like, even though, yeah, you don't want to be the biggest you've ever been in your wedding photos, mm-hmm. First, A, it's refreshing that you were able to talk about that, and B, yeah, I think it's just, I guess what I'd want listeners to take home is just to celebrate your body for what it can do, not necessarily what it looks like or the ideal body weight. Because I feel like in athletics, there's so much pressure to look a certain way.
Yeah, and every athlete has a different body type, and some of those are going to be lower in weight, leaner, and some are going to be heavier. And in this case, I needed to be a bit heavier, but it wasn't necessarily my first choice to have probably the most shared photo of me of all time be a photo of me holding a Red Bull in a Speedo, like literally 30, 40 pounds heavier than I normally am, on the boat right before I started my English Channel swim. And it was just kind of ironic. And it just gave me, like I said, a kind of a new appreciation for, being cognizant of body issues and awareness, and, just being a little more empathetic to those who struggle with that.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate your vulnerability in talking about this topic, because like I said, it's not something I hear a lot of other male athletes talk about. And so along those lines of talking about things that a lot of male athletes don't talk about, I wanted to talk about the try for equality portion, because you did your Ultimate World Try. You called it a try for equality. And I mean, to be completely candid here, I sort of had asked for your help with the whole gender equality bit. But yeah, I wanted to start talking about that.
Yeah, so when once the Ultimate World Triathlon started coming together, I wanted to talk about another issue. And to be honest, at first I didn't really know what it was. But as I kind of sorted through the different things that I'm passionate about and things that I thought were a worthy cause to bring awareness to, I decided that gender equality was going to be it. And a lot of it has to do with a lot of my experiences with you, my Caroline. And One example of that was just when we first started dating, and we would go out into the backcountry. And of course, I was an athlete, but I was pretty new to the backcountry scene. And we would go out into the mountains, and when we would approach other groups, they would generally kind of address me and ask me where we were headed or what the snow conditions were like. Or we even had someone come up to us and kind of say, "Oh, he asked me, who's your little friend over there?" Like, not knowing that my quote unquote little friend over there was a total badass skier and the one who was actually taking me out basically for a tour and teaching me the ropes. And so people generally thought, because I was, you know, I'm 6'1" and I'm a man, that I was guiding you. But in a lot of instances, particularly from the start, when we started backcountry skiing, you were the one taking me out. And so I think there's a lot of implicit bias that guys don't really recognize. And so I think that's kind of the first step in this whole thing, is to have men recognize the implicit bias that's out there.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I mean, in my career, I never really wanted to sort of become a spokesperson for gender equality, because it's just such an uncomfortable thing to talk about. So I really appreciated that you created this gateway for people to start engaging in this conversation that's so difficult. And I think that a lot of it was, I just felt like I needed, it's a lot of, I guess, emotional labor trying to have these conversations with people online and in the real world, even just something as little as, like, I was telling you this example. I'm in this organization, and I had chimed in with an idea of something online, and in the email thread, two other people were like, "Yeah, that's a great idea." And then the third person was like, "Yeah, thanks, guys," to the two guys who had just commented on it, for their idea. And it's just this, like, way that I feel like sometimes women's voices get, they just are forgotten or they're not recognized. So I really appreciate your help with that. So what other advice do you have for men who want to become advocates for gender equality? I mean, I think you touched on one, recognizing
implicit. Yeah, I think the first one is recognizing it. And hopefully my example is just one little thing you can think about. I think going and taking an implicit bias disruptor test kit is another way. And you can find that on our foundation website, which is bigmountaindreams.com. And there's a little test in there and just some certain things you can say just in our everyday lives, always referring to a group as, "Hey guys," and those kind of like little tiny things, which, you know, those things aren't going to necessarily change overnight. But I think recognizing that it's not as inclusive is kind of the first step. So doing that. And then I think the next one is just kind of calling people out, which is really quite difficult to do, in all honesty. But when there is a sexist remark, or just if you know, if a woman's voice is not being heard, being the one to chime in and say, "Hey, you know, this was a woman's idea," and then just in your everyday lives, giving women the opportunity to succeed and encouraging them. So I think in that implicit bias disruptor, there's a couple of things that we generally do with guys. Like if you're going to climb some big mountain, it's like, okay, yeah, you know, you tell the guys like, "Yeah, I know you got this. You're gonna do great," that kind of thing. And to the women, it's more kind of like, "Are you sure you should be out there?" That kind of thing, where it's not in your face sexism, but it's all these little tiny implicit bias things that we do on a daily basis. So, you know, I knew from the start that this doing this as a try for equality wasn't necessarily going to change the world overnight, but I think it's an opportunity to start talking about these issues. And I did hear from certain guys that said, "Oh, I started recognizing some of these things that I was doing." And so in that sense, I think it was a success. And of course, it could always be more successful, but that's why I want to continue that message going on and having those conversations.
Yeah, I really appreciate that that desire to try to, you know, you knew you were going to get a lot of eyeballs on your project, and to use it with this greater call to action, I think is really, really cool and admirable. And really what this podcast and this show wants to touch on is how we can use sport to change the world. And even if it doesn't happen overnight, just making progress. So I wanted to ask you a little bit more, like, about just in your relationship with me, what kinds of things you do. Like, I mean, who does more housework in your relationship and little things around the house? Because this is something I really appreciate about you as a partner.
I think they're definitely shared responsibilities. I think, and I think we do share them. I mean, I honestly probably do more cleaning than you do, and probably more cooking and some of those type of things. Maybe it's partly just my personality. I mean, I love to cook, and I probably got a little titch of like OCD cleanliness, that kind of stuff. So a lot of that does fall on me, but that's just being in a relationship in my eyes. That's just like, you know, if I want things clean, of course, those are conversations and communications I can have with you. But ultimately, like, part of that just is just picking up the, like, I guess, if that's something that I value, I'm just going to do it as well. But I think that it doesn't need to be kind of gender based, as far as that, obviously the stereotypical kind of history is that the woman is around to do a lot of those things. And it certainly doesn't need to be that way.
I really appreciate that, because I'm not very good at picking up and organizing around the house and stuff. I do love to cook with you, and that's something that we share a passion for. But I appreciate that you don't just have this like narrow view of what a woman should be and what her role is in a relationship, because like I can be very feminine, but I also have more masculine characteristics, and I appreciate that you just let me be. We both try to let each other be the best version of ourselves, and I think ultimately that's what we're trying to do with this work, with the equality, this movement, is just creating a world where people can be a more flexible version of themselves.
Indeed. I also know that if I told you to stay home and clean the house or cook for me and not like go to the mountains and go skiing, that our relationship would have been over a long time ago. So that comes from you being a strong woman and knowing what you want.
Well, I appreciate that. I feel like you have a great example from your mom too. Like, I mean, Cindy is just like, I just love that she's very candid and frank, and she's like, you know, she is more of a, you know, she's more of a home production specialist, as I like to call stay-at-home moms. She does work, but she's also just has this like just really strong, awesome personality. And so I feel like coming from an example like that, and your grandma too, like your grandma Joyce is kind of a badass.
Absolutely. And so you come from a strong woman mentor, your mother as well. She's a powerhouse for sure. And works really hard and is really good at what she does.
And your dad too. I mean, it's super cool that Jim was so supportive of you throughout this whole process, and like just every step of the way, I felt like your parents were really encouraging, and that was really cool to see.
Absolutely.
It takes like a lot of support to be able.
They were really great through this whole process. I think you mentioned at the top of the show that I work with my father, so I sell residential real estate with him, and we work on a team, and when I'm gone, he picks up my slack, and when he is gone, I pick up his slack. So I'm always encouraging him to go on vacation so that I can go on vacation and not feel too guilty about it. But in this case, I knew I was going to miss a significant part of the year, and he was super supportive of it. I think part of the whole bike tour idea came from when he was 40 years old. He did a bike tour across New Zealand, and I remember him leaving to do that. So when I started the bike and I was having a really hard time, he had some really great advice for me, and it was really special to have that advice from him.
What was that advice?
I think it was just take every day one at a time, right?
Well, I think that it was at the beginning of the ride, because we had planned.
First, like, 5 days or
You had planned to do it. Like, I was going to crew you for the first 10 days or so, and then you were going to go and go self-supported. And so you had your bike weighed down with all the stuff you were going to need for when I left. But I think what your dad said, like, after the first few days, it became clear, like, your plan of doing 130 plus miles a day and doing it in 30 days was going to be really, really hard to stick to. And I think his advice was, like, something about adjusting the plan.
Yeah, I think it was. And now that I think about it, I think the other thing that he's always taught me is to stop and smell the flowers. when I go on like backpacking trips and that kind of thing, I generally like tend to kind of walk too fast and those kind of things. And I knew that if, on this ride, that if I was going to try to do 130 miles a day, I literally wouldn't have time to like enjoy any of it or take any photos or anything like that. Just really enjoy it at all. I might have been able to get it done, but it would have just been really no fun at all. And this was the last leg my triathlon, the bike was. And I think he really encouraged me to, instead of like get back to work and do that whole thing, he said, adjust your plan, stop and smell the flowers a little bit, enjoy this. This is a once in a lifetime thing. And that he's taught me that throughout my life, not just on the bike, but that at that time I really needed to hear that it was okay to take a little bit more time and enjoy what I was doing, even if it was still going to be hard. At least I could enjoy parts of it and savor it a little bit.
It was a really sweet interaction, I thought, because I mean, for me, like how I've known Jim, he hasn't been a man of too many words. Like, he's not as chatty as your mom. He tends to be pretty succinct. But I remember that moment when you were just like completely beat down. We were both pretty beat down because crewing was way more work than I realized. And I wasn't the best crew person because I was selfishly wanting to ride with you in the mornings.
You did great.
I know, but I could have been like, if we had really wanted to keep you on that plan, I could have just been fully devoted to crewing instead of riding myself. Yeah. But it was just a really sweet moment where I thought your dad really gave you some amazing advice. So, absolutely. Okay, at this point, I wanted to go into a couple questions that I had received from people on Instagram when we were going to do the Instagram Live. So the first one is, how did you two meet?
We met online, virtual dating, basically. Not really the traditional way, though. We met on Instagram. So basically, I had followed you, Caroline, online at one point, and then I think you had followed me, but then you unfollowed me because I didn't post for a long time, like a year or something like that. This was super early days.
This was
days,
like 2012. Like, we were both Instagram. Early adopters on Instagram.
Yeah, so I hadn't posted for a while, but I was having dinner outside in Salt Lake, and I watched these two girls go out into the street and take a photo, kind of with a sunset in the background. One of them was pregnant, and it was actually Caroline taking the photo of our now good friend. Well, Caroline was friends with her, obviously, before, but Brooke. And so I turned to the guys I was with, and I was like, hey, I know who those girls are from Instagram. I follow them. And I was like, I bet both or one of them will post in the next like 5 to 10 minutes. So I got on my phone, and sure enough, like 5 minutes later, Brooke posted the photo, and it was her baby bump. She was pregnant at the time, with the sunset in the background. And so I responded to that. I commented on it and said, look to your 6 o'clock. Just saw you take that photo. Look to your 6 o'clock. Hashtag creeper.
And I was absolutely horrified because, like, I had been, like, starting to deal with some sort of creepy cyber stalker situation. And I was like, who is this weirdo commenting? But I had recently gone through a breakup, so I was single. And Brooke encouraged me to go over and to talk to Rob and this group of guys.
Which she didn't really do. She came over with Brooke, and Brooke did all the talking. Caroline was, you could tell, either mortified, nervous, or just not talking. But Brooke kind of went into, oh, what are you guys doing tonight? There's this lunar eclipse, and
yeah.
Caroline's looking to, you know, watch that, and looking for someone to watch it with. What are you guys up to? And I was like, oh, we're going to the Jazz game. It was like a preseason Jazz game, not a big deal at all. I was just with a couple of friends, and so after a couple minutes of chatting, we split ways, and we started walking to the Jazz game, and I was thinking to myself, gosh, I think I was kind of getting an in there, like, maybe I should like reach out. And so, after the Jazz game, I sent Caroline a message. Oh, well, I'm going to watch the lunar eclipse later, of course. And I've got this great spot. And I didn't really, I just kind of had like, I figured I could figure out a spot. I didn't hear from her. And then was it the next day that you reached out to me?
Yeah. You emailed me at like 10:30 PM. The lunar eclipse was at 4:30 in the morning. That lunar eclipse was really important to me because there was this series of like 3 or 4 lunar eclipses within like a year. And the first one I had seen on the glacier in Alaska with my friend Liz Daly. And then a few weeks before I met Rob, like a week before, I think, Liz was killed in an avalanche. And so I was just like in a really sad place in my life. And I thought it was a little serendipitous that I met Rob right around that time. Well, I'll get into the next part of that story in a second, but anyway, so I looked up Rob online and I saw that we had some mutual friends. And so I asked one of them if he was a good guy. And she was like, yeah, he's a great guy. And so then I was like, okay, let's do dinner on Friday night.
Yep. And so I should mention that I did sleep out on my back deck that night, and I set my alarm for like 4:15 or something, 4:20, and I watched the
eclipse. And I slept through it.
Yes. Yeah. So I did watch it. It was a hard time to watch an eclipse, but I did check it out. I took a couple photos, that kind of thing. But anyway, we were going to do dinner, I think, in Salt Lake, but you came back and said, nope, let's do it at your house. And I was like, okay. And I guess you wanted to see how I lived and kind of like who I was from that perspective instead of just like going to a regular dinner.
Well, I was at the point in my relationship journey where I was just sick of heartbreak, and I was sick of dating the wrong people who weren't going to work out. And so like I knew that if I could see his house, I knew that he was an okay guy, like he wasn't a stalker or a weirdo, because I had gotten a few friends to vouch for him. And so I was like, I wanted to see where he lived, and I wanted to ask him all the hard questions up front so that if the answers didn't work with what I wanted, that I could just not get attached, not risk the heartbreak, and move on to the next one. Because I was really looking to find a long-term companion and a husband. Like, I really wanted to get married. So yep. Our first date, we yep. cooked pasta. I made pasta sauce from tomatoes from my garden.
Yep.
And you made homemade hummus.
Yep, to start.
We made a salad.
Yep.
I really enjoyed cooking with you. Oh, yeah, Moscow Mule.
Yep. And she asked a lot of those hard questions like, do you want to get married? Do you want to have kids? Have you been married? And all these
Do you have
things.
Kids?
Yeah, do you have kids? All these kind of really big questions. And I think she's even asked me afterwards, like, oh, like, did we have, like, love at first sight? Did you know I was the one when we first met and had that first dinner? And I kind of thinking back on it now, I think we had a great evening, but I was also, like, a little bit, whoa, that was a lot of, like, big questions, but I thought it was fine. But it definitely kind of took me a little bit to come around. And I don't know, I think it was just a lot of information that first time, for that first evening.
I think though, like, I was in the same boat. I was like, yeah, maybe this could work. It wasn't like fireworks and crazy like drama. But I think when I really fell in love with you was on our second date, when we went and hiked up to the top of the Snowbird Tram. And it was like in the fall, it was the first snowfall. And I was doing this training, like this following this program from Training for the New Alpinism, and doing these hikes with like weight in my backpack. Yep. Trying to do like 3 to 6,000 vert or whatever the workout was for that time. And I invited you to do it with me. And instead of just like keeping your backpack light, you filled it up with like a ton of weight with water, and you did the workout with me. But what I appreciated the most is that you let me set the pace.
Yep.
Because you understood like how training works.
Yeah.
And like it was supposed to be zone one workout where your heart rate doesn't get too high.
It wasn't my place to jump into your workouts and show you how manly I was and that I could make it up the hill faster than you. But we should maybe mention, I think you had a lot of question marks about me because of our interaction at the start of that date.
Yeah, so Rob came over to my house and we were going to meet there, carpool up. And I was like, he was from Park City. I lived in Cottonwood Heights. And I was a little bit worried that he wasn't going to have like the appropriate layering for a cold day in the Alpine. So I was like, hey, make sure you bring good layers. And
she asked me multiple times, like, do you have this layer or that layer? Do you have enough warm clothes and all this kind of stuff? I'm like, I know how to take a hike. It was what I was thinking. And so I basically... I always have my swim bag in my car, and it's just kind of there so that if I have a chance to go swimming, I've got all my stuff with me. And so I thought it would be somewhat funny. I probably thought I was like trying to show off or do some like statement thing or something. I don't even remember, but I decided that, when I got to her house, I was going to go into the bathroom and then say I needed to get ready for the hike, and put on some clothes. So I did that, and I came out in one of my Speedos. And was it my tuxedo Speedo?
Tuxedo Speedo.
Yeah, tuxedo Speedo. And I said, like, I'm ready to go. And she was mortified, like, who is this guy? And why is he in my house? And why is he in a Speedo?
Why is he, like, almost naked? Yeah. I was, like, horrified. And as I've gotten to know Rob better and just, like, swimmers in general, I didn't really know, like, that swimmers are really comfortable in Speedos, but like I was very uncomfortable with this large man that I just met in my home nearly naked. Like I was like, okay,
it was super awkward. I came out and then I was
super
like,
awkward.
Okay, I guess I'm going to
not. It didn't work at all.
I thought I'd get like a laugh out of it. No, I think I was trying to be funny is what I was trying to say.
You were earlier. Trying to be funny, but it did not work with me. And no. So I was like, okay, go get dressed. This is so awkward. But it got better from there, and yes. You wore an actual swim trunks when we went after our hike. We went to this the snowbird cliff spa, and we went to the pool and the hot tub afterward. And you didn't wear your Speedo there.
No, I had my regular suit, and we got to have our rehearsal dinner / pool party at that same pool, like 5.5 years after that. So that's pretty cool.
And we got married at the top of the peak where we had that first hike where we really fell in love.
Mm-hmm.
So that was cool. So what advice would you have for people who want to meet other people through the internet?
I honestly don't think I'm the right person to ask that question. I mean, yes, we met through the internet, but it wasn't, I mean, I would say just be open to whatever's coming your way. I wasn't really looking for particularly like a relationship at the time that we met. And I think maybe you were, maybe you weren't, you were just newly out of a relationship, but I was just kind of open to what was out there. And to a certain extent, I think I was kind of honest, like, hey, I'm creeping on you guys. You gals, sorry about that. But I think just kind of being open to any kind of interaction, whether it's in person or online, I think that love is usually going to find you when you're kind of least expecting it.
Well, I wanted to just like touch on this because a lot of people ask me like, how do you meet people to go on adventures with? And I've met a lot of good partners and people from the internet, from Instagram and from other like meetup groups or other things. And so I think there's still like a weird stigma for people putting themselves out there. But I guess what I wanted the take home to be is that it's okay to put yourself out there.
Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, there are some disadvantages and some tough things about social media these days that obviously I think hopefully we can improve upon. But there's also a lot of great things about interactions that we can have with people online and meeting people with common interests. And whether that's just friends or, you know, partners to do activities with or potentially life partners or all of the above.
I agree. Okay, what's your most embarrassing nickname for each other and how'd you come up with it?
You want me to take this?
Yeah. It's embarrassing.
It is a little embarrassing.
I don't know that I want this out there, but we kind of need to answer it.
All right. I think I started calling you Darlin' at some point. That kind of morphed into Darls, which is, I don't even know what that means.
We kind of say it with a Southern accent, yeah, too. It's like Darls. Emphasis on the D.
Yeah. It was really, really
super
awkward.
Super embarrassing.
And once I started calling you that, I think then you started calling me Darls. And so
Big
we were
Darls.
Both, and then you're the little Darls, and together we are the
Darlses.
Super
we're
awkward.
We're so nerdy. Yeah, that's super, the thing most people don't realize is that we're just super dorks.
Yeah, but we know it's endearing and it's kind of fun. And so, yeah, now people know our awkward nickname for each other.
Okay, yes. I wanted to go now to talking about advice for people who are training for their first big race or expedition. I want to go back to the sports side of things, okay, away from the relationship, because I feel like in our dynamic, I come from the ski background and skiers don't really train. Like we just go and ski. And like when I met you, I was just starting to learn about real training, and your triathlon background really helped me realize more of my potential with sport. And so like, what advice would you have for people that are training?
It's a big kind of slightly loaded question, right? Cause there's a lot that goes into training. Triathletes are notorious for being very, precise about their training and their training plans. I had a really great coach Matt Dixon with Purple Patch Fitness. So if you guys are triathletes, definitely look him up. He was awesome.
He has a great podcast too.
Yeah, he does. The Purple Patch podcast.
Yeah, a lot of
so
good training
you could,
advice.
You could always start with just listening to some of his stuff there. He's known as the rest coach, which is sort of ironic because during my time with him, I worked out more than ever and very precise workouts, but I was basically doing two workouts a day, generally. So it would be like I'm running and swimming or biking and running every day. So two workouts, But he really realizes the importance of recovery and rest, and how that really, that's where you get all your gains. So I would say that I think a lot of people kind of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the best advice that I can give in a short amount of time. I think a lot of people that are training kind of tend to overtrain and not get the recovery part. But I think a lot of people train in one zone all the time as well. So you really need to push it really hard sometimes. And then other workouts are really meant for recovery. So you might be still going on a bike ride, but some bike rides are going to be on intervals and some are going to be super easy. And you really have to keep those easy. A lot of people, I think, get right in the middle in their sweet spot where they're breathing a little bit, so they feel like they're working out, but that doesn't really give you the gains. You got to really work hard and then just kind of pedal it out other times, I guess, if you're on the bike. But I don't know, I give you advice throughout the through our relationship. What are a few that have stood out to you?
Well, I think one of, like what you said first about like your coach being the rest coach and kind of learning how to rest, because I had a really hard time with that for like when I was getting into it, because you're like in this training mode, you're paying for a coach. So you want to hit all the workouts, and it can be hard to put your ego aside and admit that you need rest, more rest, or when other things come up. And I think another thing I learned is like you have to factor in all the other kinds of emotional and mental stress in your life. Like if you're traveling a lot, that puts a lot of wear and tear on your body. And even though you're sitting in a plane, you still need more rest when you get home. And I really appreciate that when I'd get home from trips in the early days of our relationship, that you kind of made it acceptable for me to take days where I would just sit and watch Netflix all day.
Yeah.
And as bad as that sounds, like that is something that has been really important to have those gains and to save your energy for those big days.
Yeah. That being said, I don't want to overemphasize the rest part, because there's rest and recovery. I will say that a lot of times if you're not feeling great, starting like before workout or even at the very start of a workout, usually you have to give it a good like 15, 20 minutes or something like that, depending on the workout. But usually we all know that like sometimes it's hard to motivate to like say get out of bed or start a workout. But usually once you finished it, you feel a lot better. And typically after a warm up, so 15, 20 minutes of, maybe you're supposed to go ride for 3 hours or something like that. After 20 minutes, you usually feel a lot better than when you start the ride or before. So I will also say that when you're not feeling it, go for it. And if you're after 20 minutes, you're still really not feeling it, then maybe you should start trying to figure out what's going on in your body. Are you just unmotivated mentally that day, or does your body really need some rest? And sometimes it's okay to pull the plug on a workout like that.
Yeah, I really like that. I wanted to see, so as I started dating you and stuff, I also got more into doing races. So I've done a couple of Skimo races, and then running races, road biking, gravel biking. So I've done some cool, fun things like that that I'd never really done before. And so I wanted to ask you what race day advice you have for people. And this could apply also to like a big day in the mountains or a long trail run.
Yeah, the first one is to never do anything different on race day. That's what you've prepared for. So, and everyone has made this mistake. Every single athlete has made the mistake of getting a new pair of shoes for race day, or just making tiny mistakes. One race the day before a triathlon, I was walking through kind of the vendors that were there, and I got these stretchy shoelaces and put them in my shoes, and that allowed me to take my shoes off and put them on a lot quicker. And I put them on, they felt great. This is awesome. But they were just a little too tight, and I was doing a half Ironman, and about 10 miles into the race, I couldn't feel my feet because they were just a little too tight, and I literally had to stop. I thought I had massive blisters and all these kind of things, so I had to stop and take my shoes off in the middle of the race. So the first piece of advice is to not do anything different. Other race day advice.
Matches. The matchbox.
Yeah. This goes for races, but it kind of goes for, I guess, like big days. Like
life in general.
Life in general.
Like planning projects throughout the year.
Yeah. I think this was advice from my coach, Matt, as well. And he kind of said, you have a match box full of matches. And particularly on like a half Ironman or something like that, you can imagine that every time you kind of sprint ahead, like if you're in the water and you want to get in front of someone or something like that, you can imagine like striking that match, and it gives you this initial energy, and you pass the person and you feel great. But you only have a certain amount of matches in that match box. So you have to really be cognizant of how you're using them and when you're using them, and you got to leave a couple matches in the match box for the finish, because obviously bonking is a huge thing, so you got to make sure to leave that energy in there. So yeah.
And then I mean, the other thing I want that I remember you told me is before I was getting to ready to do this bike ride challenge where I was going to ride all the canyons outside around the Salt Lake Valley. So Little Cottonwood, Big Cottonwood, Mill Creek, Immigration to Big Mountain Pass. And I was going to do it with my niece, who's like just, she's 25 and she's just an animal. She was an Olympic trials swimmer, D1 swimmer, and she's just lungs and legs. So before I did that, you gave me this great piece of advice to run my own race.
Yeah.
And we're doing it as a team, but to not compare myself, not try to keep up, you know, like people can wait at different times. And I thought that was really good.
Yeah. I think in races, obviously it's good to have some competition where you might know someone in the race that you're trying to beat or something like that. But ultimately the best way to beat them is to run your own race or swim your own race or whatever it may be. I've always found it's much better to start a race slower than you would expect it, than you would normally expect. Oh, yeah. Or want to. It's much, much easier throughout the course of a race if you are passing people, and that gives you that extra jolt. That literally almost puts like more matches in your matchbox. So if you can start from behind and start slowly and then continually pass people, that's much better than when you know, go to your local 5K, and when the gun goes off, you see these people just sprinting at the very start. And I mean, that's like just match after match. It's like putting like three matches together and right, just burning all of your energy. It's like the worst thing you could possibly do. So definitely run your own race. And if you can, run it from behind. I had kind of an interesting thing in triathlon because swimming is my best event out of the three. So I kind of had to start from the start. I had to start in front from the start. Typically, I was getting out of the water either in the front pack or in first place, and then I'd have to hold people off. It's not really how I would typically want to run a race. I'd rather, you know, start back and then be able to catch people. Mm. But I had to kind of run all my races typically from the start, not at every level, of course. The more competitive races, I still had plenty of people to catch or keep up with or whatever.
I love that advice about pacing in the beginning so that you can really light it up at the end, because I feel like I see so many times when I'm backcountry skiing or ski mountaineering with people that aren't as experienced, for a long day they go out so hard at the beginning and they just run out of gas when it's time to drop in, and that's when you really need to put it all together. And so I think that's probably been one of the best pieces of advice that you've given to me. Yeah. So I appreciate that.
We've definitely gone on many a backcountry ski tour where with a new partner, and I think from the start, because you're a professional skier, backcountry skier, mountaineer, I think people feel like that you're going to start off super fast, and so they're kind of pushing the pace, and we've many times had to be like, whoa, chill out here, we're just going for a little walk. And like totally. You said, you want that energy from the top, because that's hey, if you don't have the energy when you're at the summit, then you could really get yourself in trouble.
Absolutely. Okay, I want to move on to talk about injuries. So you've had quite a few injuries in your life. How many broken bones have you had, Rob?
I would have to count, but I think I've had, if not 20, then close to 20 broken bones.
That's wild. Yeah. So how do you deal with injuries, and what advice do you have for our listeners?
I typically just think of injuries, obviously they're almost all accidents because they're acute injuries. Some of them are longer term, but so they are accidents, but I also feel like it's, whether it's the body, my body, or it's the universe telling me it's time to take a little chill out and relax and maybe rest, recovery, as we kind of talked about before, I use that time to really just let my body recover. And what's ironic is, you know, kind of going back to the whole rest, recovery, pushing hard thing earlier, I think typically It doesn't come back right away, but if you break a bone and you have to take 6 weeks out, you know, there's usually a gradual period where you're kind of getting your fitness back and whatnot, but it always, to me, seems like it comes back much better. And I think it's because of that forced rest that you get.
Yeah.
So as much as it can be kind of devastating to take a month to maybe sometimes longer off, typically when you come back, not only is your body kind of ready to take that volume of training on again, but the same thing, you know, with your mind, maybe you were in this routine and you were in a great routine of getting up every day and doing your workout or whatever, but it was more just kind of like robotic in a sense.
Yeah.
And when you go through an injury, and you're finally able to go to do those workouts, you're like super psyched on them as well. And that I think that positive attitude, not that it was necessarily negative before, but that positive attitude goes a long way. And so you can actually have a lot better training sessions.
I think the other really beautiful thing I've learned about seeing in the injuries that I've sustained and the ones you've sustained is that, like, when you're training a lot, it takes a lot of your time. And when you have an injury, it creates a lot of space in your life. And at first, that space and that time is very uncomfortable because you're like, what do I do with all these hours in the day that I used to be training? But I think it can lead to some really beautiful unforeseen outcomes. Like, for instance, the story we started with, when you had ankle surgery and on the doctor's table, you decided to do the English Channel, which led to probably your greatest accomplishment in sport ever, the Ultimate World Try. And similarly, I wanted to go back to the story I know about of your knee injuries with triathlon. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I had different knee injuries, but right after I had had some of my best races, really my two best races, when I had was the world champion in half Ironman in my age group, and then I had a race in Hawaii on the Ironman course, but it was a half Ironman, and I remember passing the current pro world champion Pete Jacobs on the back bike, and he was having an off day. He had some injuries I think he was dealing with, but I remember just thinking, oh my God, I'm like passing the world champion right now. And so I was riding pretty high as far as like my triathlon was going. And then I was running one day and I just had a little tweak. I didn't do anything different. I wasn't able to train consistently. And instead of going to Ironman World Champs, I had knee surgery. And honestly, that particular injury didn't kind of resolve itself right away. I think a little bit like what you're experiencing right now. I had an initial boost after I got out of rehab where I felt pretty good. And I started training, a decent amount, kind of easing into it. And then I still had some pain in there that wasn't kind of allowing me to train consistently. So that all kind of ironically led to me meeting you in, this weird way and, our lives coming together. And, yeah, it's just funny how things happen and sometimes they're hard to, it's hard to realize that there's something good that's going to come out of potentially what feels like a bad situation. But if you have an optimistic attitude, I think it can.
Well, that knee tweak that led to the surgery that effectively ended your professional triathlete career, it led to us meeting. And so it took quite a few years to find that. But what you've taught me and what I've learned from my sport is that sometimes our greatest challenges and the things that are the hardest can turn into our greatest gift.
Yeah. And we haven't really talked about it today, but I'm hopeful that that's kind of the same thing with this whole coronavirus thing and how difficult it is, and not to take away from there's going to be some serious heartache and heartbreak, people losing their lives and all that kind of stuff. But I think that we will come out of this thing stronger on the other side of it. It's kind of crazy how, at least for me, I feel like, you know, this kind of forced rest, all of a sudden my days fly by and I'm like, where did my day go? I find different things to do. And I think we'll find, different positive things that will come out of this. And we will come out on the other side better.
Yeah. It's March 23rd. And right now the coronavirus is just starting to, you know, it's hitting New York City really hard. It's been hitting Italy and European countries really hard. And, more states are going into more of a lockdown. So it's a pretty challenging time right now for our country. But I think, like Rob said with his injuries and all these things, that there's these unforeseen positives that come out of these situations. And so it might take a while to find the turnaround, though. And I think, like, what I learned from my knee injury, which I've still been struggling with, is, like, it's okay to kind of grieve and to feel the pain, because it's not like you instantly find the turnaround.
Yeah.
So it's okay to cry.
It's okay to grieve or cry or, I think feel the feels.
And then
try to take something positive out of it.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on to the next question. Do you want kids? If so, when, and how will you balance sport, career, and child rearing responsibilities?
You're going to take this one, right?
No, I think we can talk about it together. Yeah. I mean, I want to ask you because people ask me this all the time and you know my answer.
Yep.
We know each other's answers. Yes, so yes. Obviously. So, but I want to hear it from you because I feel like this is something people always ask women athletes and I really want to ask a man.
Yeah. It is a conversation that we have pretty often, and it's trying to find this balance of some of the things that we want to do, like expeditions and things like that, traveling the world, and how that's going to affect our life. I think that we're excited about having kids at some point, and we know that no time will be perfect, but then we keep, every time we're like, oh, maybe we should do it soon, then we're like, well, let's get one more expedition out of the way or something like that. I think we will have kids, but I think it's, I don't know. I think we're just trying to figure out when is best for us. And at some point, we'll probably just have to jump in.
Yeah. I mean, I think that sort of like egalitarian attitude we have towards child rearing will help us a lot as parents so that we can balance training and career and all these things. And I think that if we harness it and we tell the stories, we want, you know, we keep doing the things we want to do, I think that there's a way we can continue with our goals and dreams and sport and career and everything else.
I do too. I know it's going to change a lot too. So, but I think, we can definitely take the lessons we've learned and make it work for parenthood as well.
Yeah, I think our idea of parenthood will probably be very different from a lot of people's, but I think all the things we talked about, doing your own race, not comparing yourself to other people, and not turning parenthood into a competitive sport. Yeah. I think that those will be really good pieces of advice to carry forward.
Although, if anything, I think I want, my goal would be to have other parents question if I'm a good parent.
Yeah, that's our goal, is to be the kind of parents that people question, like, are they really, is that safe?
Yeah, is that kid, you know, like, should that kid be playing in the mud like that or something? Yeah, they should.
The one, I will add one thing, the one point of disagreement that we have is on the number of children. When we started dating, I come from a family, a big family. I have 3 immediate brothers and 3 half siblings. And coming from a big family, I always said I wanted to have 3 children. And Rob is stuck at 2.
2. That's it.
But who knows? We might just have 1. No, we did not agree on that.
You asked me on the first date. I said 2. You said you were good with that.
Okay. Well, we'll go back to that. I would love to have twins, but on the other hand, I think I could be happy with 1 or 3. It's so hard to know. So, I wanted to move on to a couple. Okay. One other question about sport goals. What is your next project? And I know how we feel about this question because, like, as soon as Rob got done with his Ultimate World Try, everyone's like, what's your next project? What's your next project? And we're like, people, please give us a second to celebrate and to just, like, marinate in this feeling of, like, we just spent the last 6 months and actually a lot more than that because we had to fundraise for Everest. So with that question, I just want to preface that by saying that let people celebrate their accomplishments for a minute before jumping to that question.
But especially at this point, I think it's totally fine to ask that kind of question. Yeah, it's totally
fine. I mean, it's always fine to ask, but sometimes when you're in that place where you're so tired, it's like, come on, people, isn't that enough?
Yeah. The question, how are you going to top that? You know, you can't top that. Oh, yeah. Anyway. Yeah. I think there's a ton up in the air right now with what the next 6 months, 12 months, 18 months is going to look like with the coronavirus. We had already kind of started looking at, I definitely want to do some more channel swims. As hard as the English Channel was, I felt like, even particularly because I wasn't in like top swim shape in a sense, I felt like that went pretty well and I kind of enjoyed it in a sadistic kind of way. So I'm looking at doing some more channel swims, and we had also looked at, and we're still kind of slightly optimistic. I think I'm more optimistic than you are about potentially going to Antarctica this coming December or January. But we'll just have to see how things play out, how long this quarantine lasts. And honestly, part of the other part of it is sponsorship money,
the financial
part of it. And it's sponsorship. We're not sure if companies are going to be kind of doing that kind of marketing and sponsoring athletes to go out and do these kind of things. But also in my line of work, we'll have to see how the housing market is. And so, yeah, there's a lot of question marks around that. But usually where there's a will, there's a way. And maybe we'll have to wait a little longer, another year, to do some of these things than we had planned. But that's life. And it'll just make it even more sweet when hopefully we accomplish them.
Yep. I'm with you. So we're just taking it day by day right now. We'd love to go to Antarctica, but dependent on funding and all these other things. Okay, now I have some fun questions. Talk to me about your skincare routine. How do you keep your skin so nice considering how much time you spend in the sun?
I try to remember sunscreen every now and again, and I put it on my hands, I slather them together, and I slap them on my face. That's about my routine.
Okay, what kind of hair products do you use?
I have no idea what it's called. I get it from my buddy Billy the Barber on Main Street, and it works well enough, so I use it.
Hair gel. And do you use shampoo and conditioner, or?
Typically, I use bar soap. Every now and again, I steal your stuff. Maybe once a week, I'll put a little shampoo in the old hair.
How do you stay fresh and clean on an expedition so you don't smell bad for Caroline? For me. I don't know why I just referred to myself.
I figure you like my pheromones, so I don't really stay that clean.
You use deodorant.
Yes, I do.
You do.
The Axe.
The Axe. He does use Axe. Maybe that could be a sponsorship. Okay, body hair. What's your routine?
Well, I don't have a whole lot of hair on my body other than on my head. Let's just put it that way.
And is that a swimmer, biker thing? Triathlete? Yeah. When did you start shaving everything?
Well, I think I shaved my head a number of times from swimming, and we would shave for like our big meet of the year in high school and college, that kind of stuff. And then I think, yeah, there's a whole biker community that shaves their legs, and triathletes do that typically as well. But even though I don't do that anymore, I kind of just like the feeling a little bit more, I think.
So he's manscaping.
Yeah, yeah. So I definitely shave my legs and that kind of stuff.
You shave your chest, and you don't shave your arms or armpits, but everything below the waist.
Yeah.
Okay, favorite TV show right now?
Oh, I mean, I'm only thinking of the one that we're watching. I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but we're watching Atypical, and it's about an autistic boy. And
a boy with autism.
Boy with
people
autism.
People first
thank you.
Language.
Thank
yeah.
you, thank you, thank you. And that's interesting. But the next that comes to mind is we had a really great time watching Jane the Virgin, and you're obsessed with that show.
I love that, Jane the Virgin. Yeah. But you really liked Orange is the New Black.
That was pretty good.
What other show did
Schitt's
you like?
Creek was
oh,
good.
Yeah, you liked Schitt's Creek.
I'm waiting for the next season of Ozarks.
Oh, yeah, you love that.
Ozarks.
And that show.
I think it comes out in a couple of days here.
That show, You, that was too
was
scary
good.
For me to watch.
Yeah, I watched that by myself.
Okay, favorite color?
I mean, I could probably say like bright. I like bright colors, and I definitely wear a decent amount of like pink. Yeah, definitely wear pink.
Favorite food?
Anything that goes in my belly. I don't know. I like a variety of foods. I like cheese a lot.
You do cheese like cheese. Taco
I do like
salad.
Cheese. Taco salads. I like.
You
I like
wraps.
Sushi. I like to wrap everything. I like sauces. I have lots of sauces, like hot sauces or...
You're a saucy guy.
Not everyone loves this, but I definitely like my mayonnaise and stuff like that. Yep.
Morning person or night owl?
Definitely a night owl, but I've been forced most of my life to be sort of a morning person with swimming and early morning ski tours and mountaineering. So I definitely have to get up most mornings, but I'm definitely more of a night owl.
Okay, and one piece of advice you'd give to your younger self?
First thing that comes to mind is just trust in the process, because that could be kind of like relationships. It could be athletically. It's kind of like, things take a while to come to fruition, and just to trust that you're heading in the right direction. I think it's really easy to second guess yourself. And I think I did a pretty good job of that, but generally I think that's good advice for me now and going forward and when I was younger, and for other folks out there.
Any advice you have for people who have big dreams or goals but aren't sure how to pursue them?
I think usually you just got to kind of basically book it, like whether it's put the deposit on the boat for the swim or the deposit for Everest or whatever those goals are. Yeah, the race. If you book it, then generally it's going to happen. There are I've signed up for a race and I didn't end up even going to one of them. But generally, if you put the money down and kind of put it on the calendar, then you're going to do it. And you know what, like if you don't do it, that's okay. You just got to do it the next time. So I think, yeah, you just got to put it on the calendar.
All right. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today, Rob.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thanks. Have a good one.
All right.
To learn more about the Ultimate World Try and how you can support the Try for Equality, go to the Big Mountain Dreams Foundation, bigmountaindreamsfoundation.com. And to keep up with Rob Lee, you can follow him on Instagram at rob.lee, on Facebook, or his website, roblee.com. And please consider Rob and his dad, Jim Lee, for all of your real estate needs. Whether you're in Utah or not, they can provide you with referrals. Or if you are in Utah or Park City, they can help you with their combined over 50 years of real estate experience.